Good morning to everyone.
Build the house.
Oh, okay, good. Thank you. Today's daf is Chav Ches. We're back on Chav Zayin Amud Aleph. We're starting the new perek this morning. Eighth perek of Erechin. Last week, perek of Erechin, 7, 8, and 9 are going to take us through real estate, take us through what happens if a person buys, sells, is makdish, his properties, and the result. There are really two different periods of time to talk about. Number one, there's a period of time to talk about when Yovel is noheg, when there is a count of Yovel. So Yovel is every 50 years. It's a 50-year cycle for a 9-year cycle, machlokes tanaim, as we've discussed about many times already in the past. And when Yovel is noheg, so we know that there is no such thing as really as selling his property, but rather what there is leasing a property up until the period of Yovel. Additionally, we've also been learning, we spent most of the seventh parak discussing this topic, a person is makdish his property, he sanctifies, he consecrates his property, so now the property belongs to the Beis HaMikdash. So if he's makdish his own property, so he has now to redeem it, and he has till Yovel to redeem it. If he does not redeem it until Yovel, so he's going to lose the property indefinitely. That property will leave his family and go to the property of the Kohanim at the point of Yovel. That is subject to a machlokas, which we saw back in the seventh parak, a three-way machlokas, Rav Yehuda, Rabbi Shimon, Rabbi Lazar. But the assumption is, the halacha goes like Rav Yehuda, that you in fact lose the property at the period of Yovel, and it's distributed to the Kohanim. The Kohanim do have to pay for that property at Yovel. The Kohanim that work in the Mishmar during that particular Yovel. If it's your property that you consecrate and you're redeeming, so as I mentioned yesterday, there are a couple things to note. Number one, that when you redeem that property, see, we do not worry about what the property is actually worth, because the Torah gives a fixed value in terms of how you redeem that property. If you are redeeming the property the year immediately after Yovel, which means that there are now 49 years to go until the next Yovel, so the Torah says that you redeem it at a fixed rate of 50 shkalim for every kur, for every 30 sa'ah of property. 30 sa'ah is a volume, it's not really a linear measurement, but as we've discussed in the past, it basically comes out to 75,000 square amas. It's a nice, significant piece of property. And then what you do is that every year that you have until Yovel, if there are less than 49 years, you just simply prorate based on that fixed rate that I just gave. Okay. Additionally, if the owner of the property is the one who's redeeming it, not only does he have to pay that fixed rate, but he also has to have add a surcharge as well. It's what we call a chomesh. A chomesh is added. It sounds like it's a fifth, but really we all know it's a fourth. It's 25% of a surcharge, so he actually pays that price plus a chomesh as well. Okay. And the question, oh, fine. That's what we've been discussing up until the seventh parak, through the seventh parak. We get to the eighth parak now, so there are two topics of discussion in the eighth parak. The first topic of discussion, which we'll hopefully get through today, is the topic of what if Yovel is not noheg, meaning what then happens in terms of redemption of property when there is in fact no Yovel. Okay? And the second half of the eighth parak, which is another blot and a half of Gemara, details the discussion of Cheirem. Okay, what is Cheirem? So I'll tell you what, let's save an introduction to when we get to the discussion of Cheirem in the Mishnah. Okay. Yovel was not noheg for a significant amount of time. Even during the temple, it seems that Yovel was noheg. Meaning, what is the requirement in order for Yovel to be noheg? I'm not talking about Shemitah right now. We're just talking about Yovel. So you need the Jewish people to be in the land of Israel. The majority of the Jewish people represented by the tribes. If you have that scenario, so then you're going to have Yovel. If you don't have that, you're going to lose Yovel. It would seem to be that we lost Yovel already during the first temple. Because remember, during the first temple, Sancheriv came in, and Sancheriv removed, not, first of all the tribes to the east of the Jordan River, right? The Transjordan is what they say. And Sancheriv also removed the 10 northern tribes. So already at that point in time now, you didn't have it. You didn't have the majority of the Jewish people, and you certainly didn't have representation from all the tribes. Now
he kept the Beit HaMikdash.
Yeah, Sancheriv wanted to come down and finish the job, and didn't work out. Chizkiyahu was the king at the time. Beis HaMikdash was fine and sustained itself for a couple more centuries afterwards. Right. So that's, I heard Rav Shechter speaking about this. We're getting to that point where the majority of the Jewish people are living in Israel.
I know.
So it's, I don't know the numbers exactly, but we're close. And it's, you know, they're moving up and Galus seems to be moving down. Okay. Yeah. So it seems already by the first temple we didn't have Yovel. Now you remember we did a Gemara towards the end of Bechoros that made the suggestion that there was a period of time where the Navi brought some of the Shvatim back into Eretz Yisrael, and so there was in fact, I'm sorry, not the end of Bechoros, sorry, beginning of Erchin, right, Dantes, where there was a period of time where Yovel was, so to say, reinstated, okay. And then during the second temple, I don't know. In other words, it's hard for me to put my finger on whether Yovel was noeg during the second temple or not. Seemingly, no. The answer would be no. Meaning, you had just a small smattering of Jews coming back to Israel to rebuild the second temple, living during the period of the second temple. Okay, I do not know factually whether there was or was not Yovel during the second temple. And if I'm guessing, I would guess no. But it's just a guess on my part. Okay. Now, when there's no Yovel, so now what? So now you're Makdisha property. Okay. Temple still would love it. Temple will still receive it with open arms. And now the property belongs to the Beis HaMikdash. Right? Let's assume, for the purpose of this discussion, there was simply no Yovel during the Beit Sheni. Okay. Let's make that assumption. So now you don't have a system in place where you have a deadline till Yovel. So now what? So basically now what is that you have an opportunity as the owner to redeem the land. Somebody else also had that opportunity to redeem the land. Here, because there's no Yovel, there's no fixed rate. And it makes perfect sense. Because the fixed rate the Torah gave was only in coordination with Yovel. I mean, the Torah says that you're going to give 50 shkalim if you are redeeming it the year immediately after Yovel. So that from... Well, as we're going to learn in just a moment, there was a stay. Yeah, sure, there was stay achuza.
I'm thinking actually now.
Right.
If we did it now.
Right. Nowadays, I don't know. It's hard to say. We don't have the whole system of stay achuza, and you know, you buy property and it costs a lot of money, but we don't have the system in place. But right now, let's go back to the period of Second Temple. So you had your stay achuza, your makdish to property, you redeem it. But it's not tied into Yovel because there is no Yovel, and so therefore the redemption is not at a fixed rate. Okay, so what's the redemption going to be at? So the answer is going to be whatever its value is. So in other words, when there's no Yovel, one fundamental shift in the whole system of redeeming your property is that you no longer operate with a fixed rate, but rather you operate just simply with whatever the value is going to be. And remember, Hekdesh wants the most money could possibly get. So not only is Basin going to put an appraisal on your property, but in addition to that, what Basin's going to do is that Basin's going to do an auction. Meaning they'll simply turn to you and they'll say to you, what do you think? And then they'll turn to somebody else and say, okay, you have an offer? And they'll actually auction off the property, much like we discussed earlier in the Masechta. Okay. That's all by way of introduction. Let's begin. And Chav Zayin Amar Aleph, now we're starting the new perek. Hamakdish Shesadeh B'Shashe Eina Yovel. So if you sanctify a property, and now it's Yovel is not being noheg. So again, just, you know, I think we can assume that's basically the entire Second Temple period. Omer lo p'sachat ha-rishon, sh'abal nosnim chomesh v'chol adam eins nosnim chomesh. Who gets the first offer? The first offer is the owner. So we turn to the owner, and he gets first bid on his own property, to redeem and to buy back his property. And the reason why, says the Mishnah, is because remember, even though he's not redeeming it at a fixed rate, and even though it's just going to be whatever he bids, provided, of course, that it A, meets the appraisal, and B, is the highest bid, but we always are going to go with the owner's bid if we met both of those criteria, because he also has to add a 25% surcharge. So his bid is going to be for the Beis HaMikdash, the most interesting bid, and the one that's going to engender the most amount of money. Now, the Mishnah tells a story. And the story is of somebody who has a field, and the field is just a disaster. meaning that he puts in time, effort, energy in working the field, and he's getting nothing in return. The field for him is basically bleeding money. And so, as this field now is turning into a terrible business venture, he says, you know what? He turns to the Beis HaMikdash and says, gentlemen, I'd like to tell you that today I'm giving you this field. I am consecrating this field, he says to the Beis HaMikdash. No need to thank me. It's all yours. Amar lo p'sachat harishon. Now, the Beis HaMikdash, of course, is interested in selling the field. But of course, by selling the field, what they really mean is they turn back to the original owner and say, okay, you make the first bid. So the original owner is looking and saying, what? I make the first bid. Are you kidding me? I didn't want to, right. I know I said I consecrated it, but between you and I was really just dumping it. But, okay, I'll make the first bid. So, harehi shalibi iser. So he offers an iser. Now, an iser is a coin made up of nothing more than 8 prutas. Okay. Change. It's basically he offered loose change in his pocket for the property. Amar Rabbi Yossi lo amar ze b'iser ela b'beitza. Now, Rabbi Yossi says this wasn't an iser, but rather it was an egg. He actually offered an egg for the property. One single egg for the property. Now Rav Yossi, yeah, you have to understand, Rav Yossi is saying this is what actually happened, meaning I'm relaying the story correctly. The story is not money, loose change, but the story is rather an egg. But the Gemara will see that there is actually a fundamental machlokas running between the Tanakam and Rav Yossi. And so stay tuned. The Gemara is going to discuss exactly what that little detail in the story is all about. Shehetish nefta bekesef v'shev kesef, because you know that whenever you're podeh, whenever you redeem, it could be money, or it could be shava kesef, or it could be something which has value, right? Shava kesef, kekesef, we'll talk about that in just a moment. Amar lo yigetach, and so now the Beis HaMikdash looks around, the Gizbar looks around, any other offers? Hello, anyone? Nobody else is. Everybody knows what this property represents, and so there is no other offers. So the Beis HaMikdash takes the original owner and says, yigeticha, congratulations. The property now is belongs to you. You won the bidding war. Nimtza mafsid iser v'sadeh lefanav. And so the Mishnah now tells us, let's take a look now at his portfolio. He's got the property back in his hands. He's one iser less than he was the day before. And, okay, story's over, end of the day. Now what you get from the story is a couple of things. Number one, like we said earlier, that we go to the owner, we hadn't been first. But number two, and I think much more significantly, you get from the story, is that when we say we allow the owner to make a first offer, I would say it now a little bit differently. It's not we don't allow the owner to make his first offer, we force the owner to make a first offer. Meaning that this first offer over here is not much of a choice as it is an obligation. The Gemara is going to be very clear about this point. I'm just setting ourselves up for the Gemara. This issue about the owner placing a bid is his responsibility, not his option.
Hamak, he has a choice of how much to
correct. That's right. That's
there's no minimum, is there?
No, as is clear from the story, he could offer whatever he wanted. Although we'll see in just a moment, there may be a guideline for a minimum.
Why didn't they mention the
homage? Okay, good. In other words, I assume that, yeah, you're right. It's a good point. The mission didn't discuss it, but you know, I'll assume the Chumash is there. Same.
If he's redeeming it and it's the Yovel cycle is not being followed, does he have the Chumash or is it just the dumbing that he's giving?
No. He's going to tack on. It'll be abundantly clear in the next Mishnah that he has to add a Chumash.
Even if you're not following the...
Even if we're not following the Yovel, but you still have to add Chumash. We lose a fixed rate, but we don't lose Chumash. Chumash still stays. Okay, and I say that with confidence because you'll see the next Mishnah. It's clear. Now, the Gemara quotes a Braisa, and the Braisa says Kofin, meaning, what? If our Mishnah would have used this language, the story would have made perfect sense. And in fact, the Gemara is kind of bothered. You know, the Braisa is saying it better. Kofin means we force him to make an offer. Our Mishnah Omrim, like, you know, would you like to suggest an offer? So, my omrim nami kofin. So the first answer of the Gemara is hainuhach. It's the same thing. Meaning sometimes, you know, it's just a question of how you package something, but when all said and done, Omrim means, you know, you will give an offer, not may you give an offer. Or maybe it could just simply be a progression, meaning the first thing that happens is we suggest, would you like to give an offer? And then he says no, and he says, okay. But you are giving an offer. Okay, so we go step by step. Okay, and what we gain by that, I'm not really sure. It's just maybe it's protocol, perhaps. Shahabalam nostim chamish. We continue in the Gemara. My ear, Shahabalam nostim chamish. Tepiklei, da'aydi de'chaviv aleh, tafi upariklei. So the Gemara says, the Mishnah gives a very solid reason, a very sound reason, in terms of why we're going to make him give the first offer, which is whatever he says at 25% on. But the Gemara says, you know, I mean, we could also suggest another reason as well. It's his property. It's his ancestral field. Meaning, if he redeems it, he gets to keep it. If somebody else gets to redeem it, so he loses it. And remember, this is no, there's no yovel over here, so that's it. He lost it. So why don't we... another reason that could have been given the Mishnah is just simply, he'll do more for it. He'll give more for it, just from a principle standpoint. So va'od mitzvos geula. So I'm sorry. Typically, da'ad chaviv le'tfei uparukle va'od mitzvos geula ba'adon. In addition to that, the mitzvah should be on him first, right? The Mishnah Bechoros tells us that, right? Daf Yud Gimel says Rashi that the mitzvah of pigeon should go first to the owner, and then everybody else gets an option. So the Gemara says, okay, all those are good reasons, meaning you're absolutely right. Number one, the chumash. Number two, it's his property, so of course he's going to want to redeem it, and he'll add more to the principle. And number three, it's a mitzvah for him to do it first. Okay, so three very good reasons. Our Mishnah only mentions one of the three, but three very good reasons why he needs to make that first bid. Funny, you would think that the fact that it's a mitzvah should just simply be enough, meaning, right, we work with a halachic mindset, so just simply say it's a mitzvah. And then you can talk about all the financial benefits as well. Okay. Maisa ba'echad shehikdish sadehu. Now, the Gemara goes into the story, and the story is basically the guy wants to dump his property, so instead of dumping, he's makdish his property. But then the Gizbar turned around to him and said, okay, but you need to make the first offer. And now we look at the Mishnah more clearly. It's not a, would you like to? It's a, you will make a first offer. And so we have two versions of what his offer was, either an Isser or an egg. So Lema Ba, Kamifle Gidrav Yosef, Sarvi Sheva Kesef, Kekesef, Rabban, Sarvi Sheva Kesef, Keno Kesef. So the Gemara makes a suggestion, and the Gemara says, well, maybe what they're debating is whether Sheva Kesef, something with value, is considered money. Meaning there are many times where the Torah demands money, right? Simple example, you're Makadish a woman, right? You, even though I'll tell you what, it's not the best example, but it'll work. I say it's not the best example because the Torah never actually says that you're Makadish a woman with money, right? We learn it through Gzeira Shava. Okay, but let's for now call it a good example. Okay, even though I'm being a little harsh on myself. Okay, you buy a woman. You're Mekadesh a woman with money, okay? And the Torah there demands money. But what if you don't have money, or what if you give her something valuable? Like, let's call it a ring. Does that work? Now, we all know the answer. Yes, it does work. But you have to understand that in order for that to work, you have to say that Shava Kesef, that the equivalency of money is Kikesef. It operates halachically, it operates legally just as money does. So the Gemara is suggesting now, maybe that's the debate in our Mishnah, where the Tanakhama says he offered a coin, an Isar, meaning that when you're Poda, you need to actually be Poda with money and only money. Coins, currency. And Rav Yossi says, no, Shava Kesef is Kekesef. It doesn't have to be money. It can be something that's worth money. So the Gemara says, I do not like that proposal. The Gemara says, I simply don't like that proposal because everybody knows Sheva Kesef is Kekesef, meaning it is somewhat debated throughout Shas, but ultimately the Gemara always is going to favor the position of Sheva Kesef Kekesef. Okay. Dukuli Amma Sheva Kesef Kekesef Acha Bepodim Adav She'in B'chom She Sheva Pruta Kemiflegi. The Gemara says like this. Okay. Here's the debate of our Mishnah. We know that every time that the owner makes an offer, he also has to add a chomesh. Okay. And here we get to minimum guidelines, which is what you suggested a moment ago. Your offer, as small as you want it to be, cannot be so small that when we figure out chomesh doesn't even come out to a pruta. Meaning that surcharge, that 25% that you're adding on, has to be significant, legally significant. Whenever we talk about legal significance, the minimum that we always say is one pruta. A pruta is nothing. It's the smallest coin that they had known back then. It was, you know, analogous to our penny. Not equivalent in value, but just analogous. Right? But that chomesh has to be minimum a pruta. So maybe the Gemara is saying that's the machlokas of our Mishnah. When the Tanakhama says he offered an Easter, as I mentioned back in the Mishnah, an Easter is worth 8 prutas. Good. Right? It's not a great offer, but at least it meets minimum requirement. Because a quarter of an eighth is 2, so that's perfect. Meaning, it'll be the 8 prutas, the ister that he gave, plus another 2 more prutas. So that chomesh is at least a pruta. Actually, that in that particular case, the chomesh is 2 prutas. But that's good. And Rav Tanakhama Savar, ister de'ika b'chomesh shav pruta, parkinan. Rav Yossi, kebetza nami parkinan. And Rav Yossi says, no, I don't think so. Meaning, I agree that you have to add a chomesh, but the chomesh doesn't have to be worth a pruta. Even if the chomesh is worth less than a pruta, I still think it's a valid offer. Okay?
And the chomesh would be what?
And now the chomesh of an egg, right? That's basically what you're asking me.
Like,
I don't know. In other words, whatever the egg is worth, I'm imagining that the egg is worth, whatever it's worth, a quarter of it is not a pruta. Right? No, or let's put it in other terms. The egg is not worth 4 prutas.
Right. So the chomesh has to be worth at least.
According to the Tanakhama, the chomesh has to be at least worth a pruta. And what Rav Yossi is arguing is that no. Chomesh can be whatever it is, and it doesn't have to be a pruta. Amar lo, higi atiach nimsa mafsid isra v'sadil afanav. The Gemara is just bothered. What was the last line of the Mishnah? Meaning it gave us like a recap. But it's a Mishnah. Mishnahs don't give recaps. Mishnahs are there to make point after point after point after point. So what was that last line for? Stomach Rabbanan. So the Gemara says that last line was there to teach us that of the machlokas that we just learned between Tanakhama and Rabbi Yossi, we go like the Tanakhama, in that you have to give an offer that where its chomish has a minimum of a pruta.
So 4 prutas is the minimum.
4 prutas will be the minimum. Okay, now I've told you many times before, in your heart of hearts, all of us are accountants, right? We're hardwired for accounting. So here we come up to a Mishnah and a Gemara now that it's going to get us knee-deep in accounting. We're all going to do fine. If I could do fine on this Mishnah, we can all do fine on this Mishnah. Amar echad harei shali be'eser salayim. Okay? And we start off now with a bidding war. Okay? Over the piece of property. So the first person stands in, there are going to be 5 people involved in this auction. The first person is going to stand in and he says, I offer 10 salayim, 10 shekalim for this property. Now remember, these are people outside of the owner, so the number that they're offering is the actual number that they're offering. Meaning, right now, you don't have to figure in chomesh. So the first person says, I'd like to offer 10. And the next person says, I'd like to up the bid to 20. And now you have a simple bidding war between 5 people. Each one ups the bid incrementally by 10 shkalim. 10 shkalim, 10 slime, same thing. Now, good. So we look at the 5th guy and we smile, right? If we're the Gizbar, we're saying, perfect. The bidding started at 10, but you're now up to already 50. And so you, my friend, are the proud owner of this piece of property. Now, what this person who bidded 50 was hoping and praying is that there would be a 60. But yes. So he won the bidding war. And I'm sure story upon story is told at an auction where the person who won didn't really want it, but he just wanted to hike up the price. I'm sure that's happened time and again. And so here we are now looking at the guy who offered 50 and said, my friend, it's yours. So he says, oh, I'd like to right now opt out of the bidding. Now, It's very serious right now because in a regular bidding, in a regular auction, I don't know what the rules are of a regular auction, meaning how legally bound you are to that bid you placed forward. I'm sure there are legalities about it, and I'm also sure I know very little about it, but okay. But right now, here's what I do know. We are talking about an auction that is directed towards the Beis HaMikdash. And we have a basic rule that guides us in terms of transaction for the Beis HaMikdash, which is Amiraso Legavoa Kemesira Lehejot. That when you say something, when you make a pledge to Gavoa, to the Beis HaMikdash, so that's like a Mesira, that's like you handed something over. Meaning in transaction for the Beis HaMikdash, your word is solid. So solid that it makes you legally bound. So once you put up that offer of 50, once you raise your hand and said, I'd like to give 50, it's now no longer just you're suggesting, you're on the hook. You are now obligated to for 50. So now he's in trouble, but not in deep, deep trouble. Why? Because although he's on the hook for 50, but remember, there's a guy behind him who's going to buy that property at 40. So what the Gizbar is not going to do is say, you buy the property for 40 and you pay 50. That's not fair, right? Because at most, he was only obligating 50 shkalim now to go to the Beis HaMikdash on behalf of this property. He's back, he's falling out now, but let's for the time being assume that the 40 is still in it. He's going to give 40 for the property, so his net loss to the Beis HaMikdash was only 10 shkalim. So he only has to pay, says the Mishnah, 10 shkalim. Okay. Not as devastating as you thought it could have been. Chazarbo arba'im. Now let's learn the Mishnah Kipshuta that this is a progression.
They're going to buy the land with the money and own the land?
Well, right now, because the 50 backed out, all these people are bidding to buy the land.
Right
now the land is owned by the Gizbar, and right now they're auctioning it off to get money for the Beis HaMikdash. So, Chazar Bo Arba'im. Now, the 40 bidder says, ooh, I'm also a little bit stuck. So you know what? I'm also backing out. Memashkim and Nechasav Ad Eser. So he collateralizes his property or his possessions. Another 10 shkalim. Because remember, there's a 30 bidder. And so basically, he's going to say, look, you're going to get 30 from the guy below me, and you already got 10 from the guy above me, so I'm on the hook for 10. Okay. Now, if you think about this for just one more moment, you realize that his argument could have been, right? I don't think I really owe you the full 10. Because it is true I made a bid of 40, but the guy above me made a bid of 50. Why should I alone shoulder the 10 shkalim? Shouldn't that guy above me who bid 50... Wasn't he also prepared to not pay, just pay the last 10 from 40 to 50? He was also prepared to pay from 30 to 40. Meaning, shouldn't I share the responsibility of that 10 between me and 30? Shouldn't I share that responsibility with the guy above me? Okay. Right? You hear that argument, right? He could make that argument. It sounds like a good argument. The Mishnah doesn't seem to care for that argument. Okay. We'll talk about that later on. Chazar bo shloshim memashkim minachasav ad eser. The 20 backs out, so he pays the next 10. Chazar bo eser memashkim minachasav ad eser. The 20 backs out, so now he has to pay back down to 10. Chazar bo shel eser. Okay, and what about the first bidder? Let's say he backs out. So now you'd say, okay, he should be on the hook. But let's think about what should he be on the hook for. Because right now, the property is still in the possession of the Beis HaMikdash. So, what the Beis HaMikdash is going to do is, look, right now, you owe us 10. Okay? But we're going to sell this property. Meaning, the property will be sold. So, what we're going to do is, we'll do this once again. We'll sell off the property. Now, if the property is sold for 10, you'll be fine. Because you were on the hook for 10 for the property. We sold the property for 10, you'll be fine. But if we sell the property for anything less than 10, you're on the hook for the difference. Right? So mochenoso b'shav yavinifra mishal eser es hamosar. It's exactly what the Mishnah says. So they're going to sell the property, and whatever the difference is between 10 shkalim and whatever the sale was, the purchase sale was, he burdens the difference between the two. Okay. So far so good. That was the first half of the Mishnah. That was easy. Not really, because we're going to be discussing some points over here. But we move on to the next part of the Mishnah.
What if he gets 12?
What if he, the Gizbar, gets 12?
Yeah. How does that affect?
The 10 guys for sure okay, because now he didn't cause any loss to the Beis HaMikdash. Maybe, right? It's fair to guess that the next guy in line will also get a deduction of 2. Maybe. Okay, sounds reasonable.
Then if they sell it for 60, they're
all off. Again, it sounds reasonable. Habalim omrim be'esrim v'chol adam omrim be'esrim. Now, the Mishnah turns its attention to a bidding war between the owner and somebody else. Now remember, two things to remember. Number one, if it's the owner, so isn't it a fixed rate? So again, no, it's not, because we're talking about when there's no yovel. So because there's no yovel, so it's not a fixed rate. So right now it's just a question of auctioning and bidding war. The other thing you need to remember is that he's going to add a fifth. Whatever number he says 20, so immediately your mind translates to 25. Right? Sounds simple, but as we're going to learn in just a moment, it's not so simple. Habalim omrim be'esrim v'chol adam omrim be'esrim habalim kodmim ne'nei she'hin mosifim chomesh. So we start off with a nice, easy case. Owner said 20, another person in the room bidded 20. Okay, so we say to the owner, you won, because your 20 really represents 25. Okay. Amar achad harehi sheli be'esrim v'achas. What if one person says, I don't want to give 20 for the property, I'd like to give 21. Okay, now follow. Owner just put a bid in for 20. Somebody else just put in for a bid for 21. Okay, who should win that? Who should win that auction? The owner, right? No question. Because the owner's 20 is really 25, because he has to pay that 25% surcharge. So the Mishnah says, Habalim, turn the page, top of Chavzayin and Beis, Habalim nosim esrim v'sheish. Okay. The owner is going to now have to pay 26. Do we understand that? So I'm going to try to explain this. The Chomesh is a surcharge. Meaning, right, I know when you walk into a restaurant and you look at how much things cost, you have to understand that, right, there's a tip, right? And the tip is definitely going to have to be paid. But in terms of how we look at it from an initial standpoint, we don't look at the tip. Even though that we know that that's money coming out of our pocket, but nevertheless, though, we just simply look at the principle. Here, in the case of bidding for a property, it's true. Every single time that the owner puts a bid in, it's really 25% more than that. But as a bid goes, we don't look at it. Meaning for the purposes of the bid and the auction to the Beis HaMikdash, we first and foremost look at the principal bid itself. And so the bid of the owner is 20 and the bid of the person next to him is 21. So we say, on one hand, look, he bid more than you did. He bid 21, you bid 20. Okay, so from the first blush, the 21 bidder should win. On the other hand, the Gizbar is not dumb. Meaning the Gizbar knows that your 20 really represents 25. So even though on a principal bid he wins the bid, on the other hand, the Gizbar says, look, I'm not going to give it to the 21 guy because I have a chance now with him to get 25 shkalim. So even though from a principal standpoint the 21 did win, on the other hand, I can't just simply... I don't want to lose 25 in a place where I can get 21. Sorry, other way around. I don't want to give it to for 21 when I can get 25, so I'd like to give it to the owner. But I can't give it to the owner unless his bid at least matches the bid of the other person.
Why doesn't it match?
Right, it does? Huh? Because
it matches for, goes beyond it.
No, because from a bidding standpoint, I simply, for the moment, I ignore the surcharge. I have to. I don't have to. I understand. You don't have to. But I'm saying that's what the Mishnah's assumption is. I just don't look at the surcharge until after everything settles. So right now, from a bidding standpoint, it's 20 versus 21. 21's going to win. So now we say to the owner like this. Look, your bid, I know you can argue your bid is more. But we're not going to argue that. Your bid is 20. His is 21. So let's do the following. We're going to accept your bid of 20. We're going to add a surcharge of 5, so that's 25. But we're also going to force you to make up the difference between you and the bidder above. So that's one more shekel, so that's now 26.
Without a surcharge on the
Yeah, so right. So I was careful about the way I explained it, because what I wanted to avoid is exactly what Stuart suggested, which is add a surcharge to that extra one.
But I think that in a way, Benjamin is having it both ways.
And that's always going to be the case.
It's like
in the world, right?
Correct.
Yad hektish al ha'alyona. Right? The Mishnah doesn't use that expression, but that correct. In other words, for all intents and purposes, correct.
It's going to turn the guy who bid 21 and say, "You lost the bid because this guy's going to get 25."
Right.
They're turning the guy to 25. Say, no.
You
thought you won the bid, but you really didn't.
Right.
You have to give another.
Absolutely one. Correct. Okay, and that's. Right, that conclusion is the correct conclusion, meaning everybody lost, and the Beis Hamikdash won. Okay, it's not a nice way to package it, because we're talking about the Beis Hamikdash, and all of us are interested in the upkeep of the Beis Hamikdash. So, winner loser over here perhaps is not the best way to put it, but yes, the Beis Hamikdash has the advantage. Yeah, so that's a good question. So, like we just learned in the first part of the Mishnah, no. Once his offer is out on the table, so that's it. And now it is, right, like Ben says, it seems a little bit unfair now, because his bid is going to be upped only because the person next to him made a higher bid, which the Beis Hamikdash is going to ignore. So
if you bid 20, you have to really take up to 30.
And your conclusion is so absolutely correct. Watch the Mishnah now move its way up to 30. Esrim v'sheish, I'm sorry, Abal Nosim Esrim v'sheish. The Esrim v'shtayim, now, if the person next to him bids 22, Abal Nosim Esrim v'sheva. So now the owner's got to pay 27, right? On a bid of 20, amazing. The Esrim v'shalosh, Abal Nosim Esrim v'shmona. The person next to him bids 23, so now he has to pay 28. Right, you're following? In other words, it's 20 that he bid, plus a surcharge of 5, which is now 25, plus the difference between his original bid and the person next to him. Be'esrim v'arba, habalam nosim, esrim v'teisha. Be'esrim v'chamesh, right? Aaron, we're right at the point where you wanted us to be. The person next to him bid 25. Now he bid 20. And so now, based on everything we know what the conclusion is going to be. Nosim shlosh. The owner now, on a bid of 20, has to pay 30. Wow. It's going to be a bit of a pill to swallow, but look, money to the Beis Hamikdash, right? That'll be excellent consolation. It should be. Okay. I don't know how he's going to take it. Shein mosifin chomesh al iluya shozeh. Okay? You don't have to give chomesh on this person's offer, meaning once now it's a push between your bid plus chomesh to his bid, so that's it. But once he exceeds, once he goes beyond that on his bid, so now you're free and clear. So for you, his offer of 25 was the worst possible scenario that it could be. And the mission concludes by saying, let's say his offer was 26. And so now you have a choice. You, the owner, now finally have a choice. And you could say, look, I'd like to match. But matching means 31. Right? I either like to match, or you can simply at that point say bow out and say, look, my offer was 20. I understand 25 with the chomesh. His offer is 26. You know what? Let him have it. Amr of Chisol Oshan Ela Sheben Arbaim Omei Bim Koma Va'ein Ben Arbaim Omei Bim Koma Mishal Shem Bineihem. Okay, Rav Chisol says a halacha. Okay, and when we started the Gemara, we're going back to the first case of the Mishnah. In the first case of the Mishnah, you remember there were five bidders. None of them were the owner. And the five bidders, now each one of them incrementally went up 10 shkalim. And then when we finally got up to number 50, the 50 guy says, I'd like to back out. And then when the 50 guy backs out, so they say to Mr. 50, look, you have to pay 10. And then the 40 guy backed out. And what do we say to the 40? You need to pay 10, the difference between you and the bidder below you. And now Rav Chisda says, on that, Oshan al el sheben arbaim omed bimkoma. Aval ein ben arbaim omed bimkoma mishash meneihem. When the 50 guy pays only 10, is that that's when the 40 guy's in place. So in other words, we're only falling back to 40. But if the 40 guy's not in place, so now that 50 guy is in more trouble. Because essentially now, not only does he have to pick up the slack of the 10, between 50 to 40, But he now also has to share the burden of paying for the 40 guy, and if the 30 guy backs out, the 30 guy, and if the 20 guy backs out, the 20 guy, because included in his bid in 50 is really all those 10s, incremental 10s, that were offered by Mr. 10, Mr. 20, Mr. 30, Mr. 40. And so what Rav Chisda is saying, and it makes sense, it's logical, what Rav Chisda is saying is that 50 guy is going to have to share the burden with everyone below. So just by way of example, I'll start with Mr. 40 because he's the easiest one to explain. When Mr. 40 backs out, so for Mr. 40 now, and 50 obviously backed out as well, so not only does Mr. 50 have to pay the 10 between him and 40, he now has to share that 10 between 40 and 30, so that means Mr. 40 is going to be paying 5, and he's going to be paying 5. It will get more complex, however, when Mr. 30 backs out, because now 50 is going to be sharing with Mr. 40 and Mr. 30, but Mr. 40 is also going to be sharing with Mr. 30, so it's going to get a little bit more complicated. Yeah, we could. It's doable. The math is doable. I'm just saying it's going to be a little more complicated. Tanan, Chazabar by Mimashkanad Eser. So everything Rav Chisda is saying makes sense. It just doesn't read well in the Mishnah, because the Mishnah sounds like it's telling one story, and the Mishnah sounds like each one is responsible for the full ten between him and the one below. So Ad Eser, Amai Litein Barachim Shem Ba'adei Deleika Ben Chamishim. So the Gemara says, well, maybe when the Mishnah was telling the story, it wasn't one story; it was little stories one by one. Meaning when it was 20 and 10, that's it. It was just a 20 and 10 guy. So Chazar Ba Ben Shalshim and Mashkim and Chazav Ad Eser, Amai Velitein De Ben Arbeim Ba'adei Deleika Ben Arba'im. So the Gemara keeps doing this, meaning there wasn't a 40 guy. So again, the Gemara keeps doing that. The Gemara says, well, there was no 30 guy. Meaning, the Mishnah is not telling one consecutive story. The Mishnah is telling little vignettes, so to say. The Gemara says, what about that last case? Where I had a 20 and a 10, and the 20 guy backed out, and the 10 guy backed out. Now, what happens? So for the 10 guy, we wait till the property is sold, and then he has to pay the difference. Why should he shoulder that burden by himself? Shouldn't the 20 guy come in and help shoulder that burden? So the Gemara says, and what do you want to tell me? Same thing you've been telling me all along now? There wasn't a 20 guy. Meaning that this story was just a story in of itself, where there was just a 10 guy. So you realize now the language of the Mishnah doesn't speak to this, because the language of the Mishnah at that point should be just simply Nifraim Mimenu. Let him pay. Why are we calling him Mr. 10? Mr. 10 sounds like there's a Mr. 20 and there's a Mr. 30. I mean, the fact that we're assigning everyone numbers makes it sound like there are other bidders along as well. So Rav Chisda says, now let's put it all together. And intuitively, I bet a lot of you already figured this out. If they all step out of the auction at the same time, and they all simultaneously say, you know what, we're all out. So now that Mr. 50 now, he's going to be responsible. Not only to pay the full 10 between him and 40, but to burden the burden to payment between 40 and 30, and 30 and 20, and 20 and 10, et cetera, et cetera. And Mr. 40 is going to have to pay not only the difference between 40 to 30, but also 30, 20, 20, 10, et cetera, et cetera. In other words, if they all back out simultaneously, so then absolutely correct, each one of them is going to have to bear the responsibility of that below him and that below him, et cetera, et cetera. If it's zeh achar zeh, but let's say Mr. 50 backs out, and Mr. 50 backs out, and there's still now 40 in place, so he's only responsible for 10. And then the 40 guy backs out, but the 30 guy's still in place, he's only going to be responsible for the next 10, et cetera, et cetera. Chazu kulan ke'echem eshal sheminei va'anan tanan memashkem nechasav ad eser, ela shmamina, kidrav chista shmamina. The Gemara says, in fact, it's meduyak, it's precise in the Mishnah. Igidaram alei mirma, now when they learn this, Same basic point, just packages it a little bit differently. Tanan. Chazer boshal esam ochin oso b'shav yav v'nifra mishal esar esam oser. V'atanya, mishal shem b'neim. Now the Gemara quotes a b'raisa. And the b'raisa says, don't they share the responsibility? Amar v'chisa l'kasha, kam b'vasachas, kam b'zeh achar zeh. And answer is precisely like we just said. If it's b'vasachas, if they all are backing out simultaneously, so then each one is going to have to bear the responsibility of not just the increment below him, but all the increments below him. And each one does it. So then when you finally get to that last 10 shkalim, so that's going to be shared equally by Mr. 50, Mr. 40, Mr. 30, Mr. 20, and Mr. 10. Each one of them is only going to have to pay a fifth of that last 10. Right? Two of that last 10.
That's assuming none of them is the original owner.
Right, no, correct. In other words, this is all assuming none of them is the original owner. The first case of the Mishnah is just talking about a simple illustration of a bidding war and what happens.
Now, how can they all back out at the same time? Doesn't the 40 and the 30 have to see the 50 backed out? Because they already think
that. Yeah, when it says simultaneously, I was wondering the same thing. When it says simultaneously, I don't know exactly what we need for simultaneously. Are we speaking about Toch Kedei Dibor?
Maybe they all found out something with the field and the other cards at the same
right, time. Right. In other words, correct. Right. Some say, at the closing, as sometimes happens at the closing, one new piece of information comes out and they all say right, no. Right. No, thank you. Okay, well, we'll stop over here tomorrow. More accounting tomorrow. How else can I entice you to come tomorrow? Please join us for more money talk. Okay,